Hi, this is Dr. Mercola, and welcome to our Take Control of Your Health podcast, in which we bring you the latest cutting-edge interviews to help you achieve optimal health. This next interview is part of my Best Of series, which features some of the most popular interviews with leading health experts. So thank you for listening. Now let's get started with this week's program to help you and your family take control of your health.
Wouldn't it be nice to have a conversation with one of the smartest doctors in the country? Hi, this is Dr. Mercola, helping you take control of your health. And we're going to have an opportunity to do that today. No, not me. We're talking about Dr. Stephen Gundry, who wrote the book, The Plant Paradox, which tells pretty much the mysterious story of lectins. And we previously interviewed about that, so definitely we'll have a link to that interview. But we're going to continue the conversation and a lot of other exciting areas that you want to listen to. So welcome and thank you for joining us today, Dr. Gundry.
Oh, thanks for having me back. Really appreciate it.
So it's been a few months since we last interviewed you, and your book continues to be a success. It does not follow the typical pattern that we see for most health books, including mine, which came up and was really high, just like yours, but then it fell down. And now yours is still in the top 100 books sold on Amazon, which means you've really struck a chord. So I'm wondering if you can comment on that, and also on the critics, the fervent critics that you have, that you've generated as a result of publishing this book.
Yeah, well, again, thanks for having me back. We certainly got a nice bump from our first interview from you, and you know, thank you and your followers for kind of embracing this concept. It's pretty interesting the ride we've had. We spent 13 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, and actually just fell off last week. So it's definitely hit a chord with people, and it's really wonderful to read all the five-star reviews and read how people have tried it and definitely had some amazing successes. So thanks everyone who's bought the book, and if you haven't bought the book, give it a try. Certainly when the book began to get traction, this clearly started to bother a lot of people. The people who really came out vehemently, some of it actually really surprised me. And I won't mention names, and these people know who they are, and you can find them on the internet. But as a general category, a lot of them fall into the low-fat vegan community. And the grains and beans are the cornerstone of a healthy diet. And, you know, how dare you question what everybody knows, that grains and beans are the cornerstone of a healthy diet. And, you know, I'm not against these things. In fact, I've got a bean recipe in my book. All I'm saying is that we have to be very cognizant of the lectin content in grains and beans. And that there are ways to destroy lectins by pressure cooking beans, and makes them perfectly safe if you want to eat beans. And there's certain things that you can't pressure cook. Gluten is not degradable by pressure cooking, unfortunately, but most other lectins are degradable. So I'd love to talk a little bit deeper about some of the objections and arguments against the
sure.
book, and maybe give
well,
us a chance to
and if them. If I can give my response to those objections,
right.
I am only, at least my perspective that would be that these individuals are objecting don't really know you or your medical practice. And what I wanted to have you back, and I definitely want to touch on this in our interview, is the scope of your practice. I mean, it's really extraordinary. You just do this incredible, massive lab work. You're essentially doing research in the clinic. I mean, thousands and thousands of dollars worth of tests. So you test all these obscure components. So you are not just guessing. You tell them to stop this food and come in, and you're measuring all these biochemical pathways, and you know precisely, scientifically, from the research, what the response is. So maybe you can integrate that into your response.
Yeah, that's exactly right. When I resigned my position as professor and chairman of cardiothoracic surgery at Loma Linda 17 years ago now. When I set up my practice to do this, I, you know, didn't know anything to do but research. So I decided to make, you know, my practice a research project, and that everyone who came in to play with me, I asked them to, you know, let me have a few tubes of blood. We're actually up to, I think, 13 tubes of blood now, every 3 months. And let me send it off to labs that, you know, I think are doing cutting edge work. And one of my critics say I charge, you know, thousands of dollars to patients to do this. I don't. I base it on insurance or Medicare. They're covered laboratories. And I do an insurance-based practice. I do a Medicaid practice. So much for the critics. I'm not here bilking people of their hard-earned money. I'm trying to figure out what's wrong with them. And so I asked them to give me their blood, and then let's make some manipulations. Let's make some manipulations in their diet. Let's make some manipulations in their supplements. And this is from a guy who used to think supplements made expensive urine. And one of the things I did early on, which I wanted to keep myself and, again, my making money out of the equation, so I would tell people to go buy, you know, supplements at Costco or Trader Joe's or Vitacost or Mercola, and let's see what they did. And actually, fairly early on, I could tell a good supplement from a bad supplement based on what people were doing. And it was very clear early on that supplements had a major effect, and I wrote a number of papers about that effect, many of which surprised me, but now it doesn't surprise me at all. And I could tell when even people were changing brands of supplements based on their blood work. And so I've been doing this for 15, 17 years now, and amassed a rather impressive file of thousands of patients. And as time went on, I had better and better tests to look at the inflammatory response of the immune system, and wrote about that in response to removing or introducing some major dietary lectins. And, you know, I didn't do this with an agenda. I didn't have a grudge on my shoulder against lectins. If I could eat mashed potatoes and French fries and phenomenal French bread every day, I'd probably be a happy guy. I'd probably be a lot sicker, like I used to be. But so I have nothing against these things. It's just that as the data came forward from thousands of people, very distinct patterns emerged, and reproducible patterns. And I could reintroduce these things and literally watch the immune system get turned on again. And then I could remove some of these factors and watch the immune system calm down. So there was clearly a cause and effect.
Excellent. So one of the other comments that your critics mentioned, and perhaps you can clarify your position on this, because from my perspective, it's almost reprehensible medical malpractice to take a patient who has an autoimmune condition and not remove lectins from their diet. And it's such a simple, essentially free strategic intervention with virtually no side effects, except the good ones. So, I mean, that's the base. I mean, you've got to do that. I mean, it's just inexcusable if you have an autoimmune disease not to remove lectins. And I have not heard anyone have a good argument against that. But for those who don't have autoimmune diseases, you know, the lectins are in many of the vegetables that have seeds, and, you know, these vegetables, in addition to lectins, have many beneficial micronutrients and polyphenols. So, you know, what can you help clarify your position on, once you achieve a certain level of health and wellness, once you're there, you know, how you can integrate a small amount of lectins comfortably back in and still get the benefits of the other nutrients, micronutrients in the foods?
Yeah, you know, you're right. Almost every author in the autoimmune space Absolutely. Removing lectin, major lectin-containing foods, is kind of the part and parcel of the treatment of autoimmune disease. Anybody who talks in this space and not remove lectins, everybody else is removing lectins. So I think that's a very important part of treating autoimmune disease. And certainly I've written about this and shown it in actual patients. I just submitted a paper last night to the American Heart Association, EPA lifestyle sessions on this very subject with 102 patients who over 90 of them had complete remission of all of their biomarkers of autoimmune diseases by removing lectins within a 6-month time period. So it's a real thing. So what about everybody else? I think all of us are probably sensitive to lectins in one degree or another, but usually, as I talk about in the book, we have an amazing defensive system against lectins. We haven't been sitting still letting plants take advantage of us, and certainly plants don't sit still letting us take advantage of them. We have an amazing mucosal system that can bind lectins, but we have acid in our stomach that's pretty good about breaking down proteins. And we have an amazing microbiome, much of which enjoy eating lectin proteins. There's a gut bug that loves gluten. So we've had all this defense system. And I think when you look at traditional cultures that have not been inundated by antibiotics, by NSAIDs, by proton pump inhibitors, with all of our personal care items, then I think you can make the argument that, in fact, these guys' defense system against lectins is pretty doggone intact, and they have a really good tolerance for lectins. On the other hand, our defense system in the West has been decimated, and so we're seeing more an effect of what these lectins can do. In my first book, I wrote about the effect of hormesis, and that is, of course, that which doesn't kill me makes me stronger. And Pericles, centuries ago, defined that the dose makes the poison. Mm-hmm. And I think that's still true. And so there is a perfect balance that everybody has to find between the negative effect of lectins actually promoting health, and it's hormesis, and I agree that it's a true thing, and the tip over where every individual kind of tips over to where these things produce disease. And everybody's a little bit different. But I think, like I say in the book, that once we kind of get the gut back in shape, that we've solved the leaky gut problem, and we can see it on lab tests, then it's time to, if you want, reintroduce dietary lectins and start with small vegetables, peel and de-seed them if you want to. Certainly pressure cooking solves the problem for most people, but I have no problem and actually urge people to start reintroducing dietary lectins. But I can tell you, the autoimmune folks, they've tried little bits of things, almost always incite their immune system.
Okay, that's an important point, and I'd like to expand on it, because you and I both know what autoimmune diseases are, so perhaps you can discuss the most common ones, and if any of those particular conditions respond particularly aggressively to lectin introduction.
Yeah, so, I think if we knew what we know now about the immune system and autoimmune diseases, we probably wouldn't have chosen names. In the past, when somebody had swelling in their joints, and we had rheumatoid factor as a measurement, we called this rheumatoid arthritis. We now have a second factor associated with rheumatoid arthritis, which is called anti-CCP3. And if we, long ago, somebody had a skin rash or had a butterfly rash on their cheeks and had generalized kind of feeling lousy, we we call it lupus, and there was a lupus antigen. We now have about 5 different tests for lupus, some of which I like, some of which I still don't think are very accurate, but we use them. The most prevalent one is anti-nuclear antibody, but there's also an anti-DNA antibody, and so forth. We see a number of people with Sjogren's syndrome, which is dry eyes and dry mouth, and half the commercials you see on TV every night are these young women in general going to the eye doctor mm-hmm. who gets a prescription for Restasis, which mm-hmm. is actually an immune suppressing drug that we use in heart transplant.
Excuse me for a moment, is Sjogren's typically the most common cause for dry eyes?
Yeah, it really is. And it's amazing how many people with dry eyes have Sjogren's syndrome. So if you've got dry eyes, please ask your doctor to do the autoimmune test for Sjogren's syndrome. There's 2 of them, and they're easy to obtain, and you'll be surprised how many people with dry eyes are positive for Sjogren's syndrome.
And if that's the case, you got to go
that's, on. And that's an autoimmune disease, right. And it comes from the gut. It really does. And we could go on and on. I see mixed connective tissue disease, fibromyalgia is an autoimmune disease. Crohn's, we see a large Crohn's population, a large ulcerative colitis or microcolitis population. And these are all variants of autoimmune disease. Now, the darling of autoimmune disease right now is Hashimoto's thyroiditis. And it's really thanks to people like Amy Myers and Isabella Wentz, who have really focused the public's attention on something that's just kind of hidden in medical practice. When I started this part of my practice, I was flabbergasted by how many women were on thyroid medication. And I mean, it was startling to me. And it turns out that there is a huge population, particularly of women, I see a few men, that have Hashimoto's thyroiditis. And they were just started on thyroid because they had low thyroid. But now that we can test for anti-thyroid antibodies and thyroid peroxidase antibodies, we can see that there's a huge number of people with Hashimoto's thyroiditis. And we just didn't realize the scope of this. And quite frankly, I was taught, as well as many of my colleagues, that, women are going to come in and complain about being tired or not being right, or they want to blame their underactive thyroid for their weight gain. And we just, hand them a prescription. And in fact, there's far more going on here than just handing somebody a prescription. And we've got to do a deeper dive into this. And I really thank my colleagues in this area for bringing this to everybody's attention.
Well, we left off one of the big ones, MS, multiple sclerosis.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I'll tell you a wonderful success story and then a failure so far. Both of these women are 38 years old. One's from the Midwest, one is from California. And the one woman, I'll tell you the success story, she, about a year and a half ago, the biologic clock was ticking and she wanted to get pregnant. And she was on a couple of, really nasty immunosuppressants and realized she could not do a pregnancy safely with these. So she contacted me and we got her off of her immunosuppressants and her all of her inflammatory markers returned to normal, and she got pregnant. And interestingly enough, pregnancy is usually, for autoimmune disease, a very quiescent period. Your immune system has the largest parasite in the world in the woman and kind of takes a break. And so most of the time, MS is very quiescent during pregnancy, but after pregnancy, mm-hmm. It starts back with a bang. In fact, this woman had triplets 9 years ago. I'm sorry, I'll talk about the second one. This woman hadn't had any children. So I just talked to her last weekend, and her baby's now 4 months old, a normal, wonderful baby. She actually had her first good night's sleep the night before I talked to her. But we've been watching her labs, and she has not rebounded. Her immune system has stayed normal. She feels great. But she's one of these people who has absolutely drank my Kool-Aid, for my critics, and just stayed away from the major lectins. And she's done great. The other woman who I actually saw yesterday is also her same age. Her MS started literally a couple of days after having triplets. And she had some complications from having triplets and got several doses of antibiotics. And almost immediately, within months, began having symptoms of MS and has had it really ever since. And she's been decimated by it. She's been on just about every immunosuppressant, major chemotherapeutic agent without much success. She now uses a walker. We started with her about 6 months ago, and she's not been able to adhere to the program. And she admits it, and we can see it on her markers. And she has the excuses. She has three, you know, 9-year-old kids, triplets, and it's an incredible amount of work to feed a family the way I'd like people to eat. And she has to go to soccer games and argues that she can't take a package of nuts, that she has to buy a hot dog at the soccer game, which is pretty lethal, and eat the bun. So I spent the hour with her yesterday trying to make sense that perhaps, you know, being in a walker and deteriorating is not worth, you know, having a hot dog. And I pointed out to her there's a paper that came out actually yesterday looking at juvenile MS. And looking at the impact of saturated fats versus a cup of whole vegetables every day. And the kids who were eating a high saturated fat diet had a progression of their MS. And the kids that were transferred over to getting at least a cup of vegetables a day, these kids did much better and had far less progression of their disease. So, you know, here we have a new study in juvenile MS that basically points the way that this is, you know, this is a microbiome gut problem.
Well, I think you need to expand on that a bit, because I think you touched on it in the last interview, but it has to do with the lipopolysaccharides and saturated fat, because, you know, to our audience, saturated fat is actually healthy. But if you have a disturbed microbiome and if you're eating a lot of lectins, it can be a problem. So can you expand on that?
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. I have nothing against saturated fat. I think, just as an aside, Dale Bredesen and I would say if you're an ApoE4, which is a totally different subject, I'm suspicious of saturated fats for you guys, and you can watch my videos on that. But the problem with a disturbed gut wall, lectins and NSAIDs are pretty good at making leaky gut. They actually force the tight junctions that bind the intestinal cells together apart, and then not only do lectins get through the gut wall, but lipopolysaccharides, LPSs, and you know, I don't swear, but in the book I call them little pieces of shit, because they're actually the cell walls of bacteria. They're actually dead bacteria. They're pieces of bacteria, but our immune system views them as honest to God living bacteria. And so LPSs can unfortunately ride on saturated fats. They hitch a ride on saturated fats through the intestinal wall. And so if you've got intestinal dysbiosis, if you've got a mixture of saturated fat-loving bugs and simple sugar-loving bugs, which is the standard American diet, you've got a setup for having a bunch of LPSs in your gut. and you've got to set up for a wall that's constantly being broken by lectins. And I think that this is really one of the main reasons that MS and the other autoimmune disease get a toehold. Certainly stress, a sudden stressor, can start autoimmune diseases, like this woman, the triple pregnancy and then some antibiotics was a perfect start. I have other women with MS or rheumatoid arthritis who can name the day it started, mm-hmm. when they had a sudden, one woman's mother suddenly died when she was about 12. And actually, I'll tell you an interesting story, same line. I recently saw a gentleman who's originally from Brazil and has some pretty nasty autoimmune diseases in his 40s. And he can tell you the date that his disease started when he was 11. Mm-hmm. His mother always pressure cooked his beans and rice. And I've had now many people from Brazil telling me that that's the standard of that culture, to pressure cook beans and rice. And her pressure cooker exploded when he was 11, and it was apparently a rather impressive explosion. And so she stopped pressure cooking. And within months, he began to come down with various ailments. He got severe tonsillitis, thought it might have been mononucleosis, but he's been sick that day. And he had actually gotten my book and had read about this story of quinoa and being pressure cooked in Peru, and the light bulbs went off in his head. And he says, my gosh, you know, I started getting sick the day my mother's pressure cooker blew up. And so we're well on the path of recovery now, but
that's good.
It's little things like that.
Absolutely, and I couldn't agree with you more. In my experience in treating autoimmune conditions, specifically MS, it almost always, these individuals had some type of really serious emotional trauma. And typically it occurred before the age of 7 or even 5. Now, one of the questions I have to ask you, because I'm really curious as to your review of the data that you've collected, is the influence of vitamin D on these autoimmune conditions, specifically MS, and if you've teased out the details between those, because you live in California, so it's theoretically possible, those who raise their levels naturally through sun exposure versus those who take the supplements.
Yeah, so, I've followed for years your thought processes on vitamin D, and I've been following you long enough to even remember, and you may have even forgotten, when you came back from your vacation in Hawaii and had some issues and thought that maybe your vitamin D levels were toxic. And,
yeah, I was confused back then. But at least I was ahead of the curve. People didn't even know about vitamin D for the most part, benefits of it.
And that's why I continue to be a fan of yours, because, you know, you'll make a statement and then say, maybe that was, I wasn't too correct about that. And, you know, that's one of the things I like to think I've been able to do. I was a fan of certain things in my first book that I'm not a fan of now, and I'm willing to say that, and I say it in my second book. And so I hope that we all, when we see new data, have the ability to say, you know, now that I have new data, I was wrong about this. So back to vitamin D. I live in a community where, like you do, where people have incredibly dense tans because we have sunshine most of the year. And yet these people with incredibly dense tans often had fairly remarkably low vitamin D levels.
Interesting.
But one of the things that struck me early on in people with autoimmune diseases is they almost universally had low vitamin D levels. Mm-hmm. Now, what's low? I think the longer I've done this, that low is probably below 50. The longer I've been doing this, the more I push vitamin D on people. I actually look at whether we're sealing the gut by when I can finally start backing down on oral vitamin D. If you had asked me even 10 years ago that I would suggest to somebody that they take 25,000, 30,000 international units of vitamin D3 every day for months at a time. I would have called myself a quack, but since I was monitoring vitamin D levels on these people, some people, to this day, I've had to use, the most I've ever had to have a person take is 45,000 international units a day to get their vitamin D levels up to 70. I like people with autoimmune disease to run right around 100. Quite frankly, I've been running my vitamin D level over 120 for the last 10 years, quite honestly, on purpose. Number one, I'm not dead. I don't have any neuropathy that I should have, I suppose. And I learned this from a couple of patients about 10 years ago when we were actually quantifying levels above 100. And these people walked in sight unseen and their vitamin D levels were about 270, a man and a woman in their 70s. And I was, I was flabbergasted. And I looked at them and I said, why aren't you dead? And they said, what? And I said, well, you have toxic levels of vitamin D. And they said, who says? And I said, well, everybody says, conventional wisdom says you ought to have these incredible neuropathies. And they say, I said, how long have you been doing this? And they said, all of our lives, vitamin D, is incredibly important. So I said, that's pretty interesting. And so I've been pushing vitamin D on my autoimmune patients. And quite frankly, once the gut is sealed, their vitamin D level requirements go down quite dramatically.
Have you speculated a mechanism on that?
Yeah, I think it has to do with the absorptive ability of absorbing vitamin D.
Oh, okay.
Vitamin D is a fat-soluble vitamin, but Dr. Hollick from Boston University, who knows more about vitamin D than any human being in the world, has shown that you can absorb vitamin D without fat, and that fat is not essential for vitamin D absorption, which was certainly interesting to me. But there's an interesting theory, and there's a couple papers that suggest this, that, and I don't want to get too technical, but down at the bottom of the crypts of the small intestine and the large intestine, there is a package of stem cells that live at the bottom of the crypt. And the stem cells actually advance up the microvilli to replete the enterocytes that are shed very, very constantly. And again, not to get too technical, but it turns out that the type of bacteria that live in the base of this crypt actually do a lot of signaling to these stem cells, and we can get into that if you want to. But it turns out that vitamin D is essential to get these stem cells to proliferate. And if you have low levels of vitamin D, they don't proliferate very well. Now, why that's important is in autoimmune diseases, as most of us think, the gut barrier is decimated either by lectins or by NSAIDs or just the fact that we've been taking so many antibiotics. And we have to try and get these stem cells to replete. And if you don't have enough vitamin D to kick them out, they basically stay there. So that's really one of my main purposes in really pushing vitamin D levels on these folks. Okay. And I haven't regretted it yet.
Okay.
If you want to take vitamin K2, I certainly do. I've not seen kidney calcification. I've not seen kidney stones from high-dose vitamin D. I realize there's a potential for it, but I just haven't seen it. But I do like people to take vitamin K2 when they're taking high-dose vitamin D.
Do you measure serum calcium, too,
measure serum calcium in everybody. We also measure parathyroid hormone in everyone. And one of the things that was fascinating to me early on was the people with low levels of vitamin D almost universally had elevated parathyroid hormones, which, of course, leach calcium out of bones. And I was interested early on that as I kicked people's vitamin D levels up, that their parathyroid level came down. And so when I see people with elevated parathyroid hormone, I don't immediately go looking for a parathyroid adenoma anymore. I push their vitamin D. And if by pushing their vitamin D up, their parathyroid hormone comes down, problem solved. I can tell you that many people who are on a stable dose of vitamin D and then either forget it or they're traveling and they stop taking it and come back for a blood draw, that even, dropping your vitamin D from 70 to 50 on a level, all of a sudden their parathyroid hormone starts popping up. So there's really a cause and effect that I've been able to see with this.
Well, that's good.
I'm a big fan of vitamin D.
So it's certainly a better alternative than a parathyroidectomy. And I'm wondering ever had to stop anyone from the high dose of vitamin D based on their parathyroid levels or calcium levels.
Well, again, I like vitamin K2. I've not seen excessive calcium levels from vitamin D. I do back off people's vitamin D when, when I see people head above 100, except for my cancer patients, I'll give them the option and I'll actually show them my blood work and say, here's my vitamin D at greater than 120 for the last few years. If you want to stay here, I have nothing wrong with this. On the other hand, I should tell you that this is, cloudy territory. If you want to back off a little, that's fine with me. Interestingly enough, one of the companies that run my autoimmune tests, it's called Vibrant American, it's not a plug for them. When they measure vitamin D levels and vitamin D are above 120, they put a little sidebar that says, vitamin D levels of above 120 have never been shown to be have clinical significance. And I think that's an interesting statement for some lab to put on there.
Yeah, yes, indeed. Now, personally, I haven't swallowed vitamin D in about 10 years, and my levels remain about 70. I'm comfortable with that level. But I'm curious as to why the people who are exposed to the sunshine, as you attest to their deep, dark tan, what your belief is that why they aren't able to achieve normal vitamin D levels?
Well, I think they've got such an impenetrable barrier of melanin from their melanocytes.
So decreased exposure. That,
there's some pretty good data in Africans, free-living Africans, that their vitamin D levels are around 50. Good for you for getting a 70. The other thing that's important for us in California is, we've been inundated with sunscreen is king, and you have to wear sunscreen constantly. And a lot of my patients, even with dark tans, continue to put sunscreen on every day when they go out to play golf. The other thing that's important to realize is that most of my patients who have these deep tans actually have tans on their forearms and their face and
their body.
Their lower legs.
Sure.
But they aren't walking the beach like you do every day, and they're not getting full body exposure.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. All right, let's go on to another area that I'm really passionate about recently and partially inspired by you. I was particularly impressed with your commitment to intermittent fasting, at a prolonged intermittent fasting, 20 hours, and I've recently adopted that. And I think prior to our last interview, I wasn't a zealot, pretty much, for fasting. Not intermittent fasting, but regular water fasting, until I presented at the Low Carb Conference in San Diego. And Dr. Bredesen happened to be by there, as did one of his patients, who's a patient of his and yours, and I'm sure you know who he is. And this man is an engineer and is just incredible. I mean, just a gift of knowledge. And it was so inspiring to me that after having a dialogue with him, that I committed to a four-day water fast. And it was magnificent. Because I'm doing the 20-hour daily intermittent fast, I had no hunger. I didn't even... not a craving during, because most people have a hunger at day two or three. And I'm actually going to start another four-day water fast tomorrow. So I like to do it every month. But and then I've read Dr. Jason Fung's new book, and there's just the Diabetes Code, which comes out in January. And there is just, I mean, I don't know, and I'd like your feedback on this, but I don't personally know of any more powerful metabolic intervention than fasting.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I had the pleasure of being on a panel with Dr. Fung a few weeks ago, actually, at Mind Body Green Revitalize, and got a chance to know him, and we're both, you know, fans of each other. And I think Jason Fung makes some very good points. First of all, it's cheap.
it's better than cheap. It saves you money, not only money, but the precious resource that's more important than money, which is time. You get like two extra hours a day when you're fasting.
No, you're really right. And, you know, he makes, I think, a very good argument that once you get past 2 days of hunger, if you're not used to intermittent fasting, it becomes a piece of cake. And one of his arguments is that, you know, don't give up after a two-day water fast, because you're giving up at the time it's going to get actually incredibly easy to do. And I think what happens is we have an amazing repair system that goes into work when you're fasting, not the least of which is putting your gut at rest is probably one of the smartest things that any of us can do. Putting the wall of your gut at rest, not having to absorb nutrients, not having to deal with the constant inflow of lectins or toxins. But I think more importantly, it gives a chance, as Dale Bredesen would say, to finally do some serious cleaning of your brain. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that he and I both agree on is that we're underappreciating the impact of lipopolysaccharides on initiating the cascade of inflammation in the brain. And thanks to his work and some of my conjecture, I think both of us think that Alzheimer's and Parkinson's have a unifying cause, and that is the brain basically defending itself against perceived threat, a lot of which are lipopolysaccharides. And so if you put your gut at rest and don't have LPSs coming into your system, you really kind of, the longer you can maintain that realistically, the better off you are. And as Jason Fung would say, yeah, intermittent fasting is great. Doing like a modified calorie-restricted diet is great, but it technically so much easier to just stop eating. And you've probably seen my revised food pyramid, and you know the second level of my food pyramid is don't eat anything.
Now, the reason I like it is for two consequences, metabolic consequences. Is one is activation of autophagy, with self-eating and removal of this debris in your body that's essentially taking out the garbage. And you know, you probably as a surgeon have taken out lipomas, and I'm sure many people have asked you, well, what caused it, or how do you get rid of it? Is it surgery the only way? Well, fasting gets rid of lipomas. It eats it up. Imagine that. You don't have to surgically excise it. So, yeah. But I mean, to me, that's one of the most powerful components is activation of the autophagy process. And the second is regeneration of stem cells. So I wonder if you could comment on those two phases, which is why I'm such a big fan of fasting.
Yeah, what I tell my patients about fasting is we live at the base of a 10,000 foot mountain, and we have hot air balloons that give people rides. And you know, I say, okay, let's suppose we're in the hot air balloon, and we're caught up in a wind, and we're heading towards this mountain, and we've got to get over that mountain. And what are we going to do? Well, we're going to start throwing things overboard that are holding us back. And you know, we're going to throw out the sandbags, we're going to throw out the lunch and the wine, and then we're going to start looking at each other going, okay, which one of you guys is going over? Well, when you're in a period of fast, your body doesn't know when that fast is going to end, because all of a sudden famine has set in. And so we initiate, you know, deep survival mechanisms, and our immune system looks at every cell in the body and takes an account and says, you know, this cell doesn't look quite right. I'm going to tell you to die, autophagy. And so on. And so we actually selectively select the survivors. And that actually gets into stem cells. We know that in cancer chemotherapy, one of our Achilles heel of cancer chemotherapy is that the stem cells are not affected by chemotherapy and they survive. And so there's a deep-seated desire to keep stem cells not only intact, but actually ready, because they're the best there is, to take the place of these cells that are not pulling their own weight. So I think this is, you know, all great religions have a fasting tradition. And it was, you know, it clearly had a purpose far beyond, you know, showing what a devout person you were. And I think all, you know, these things have been practiced since time, probably because long ago we fasted because we had to. Mm-hmm. And we're unique among many animals in that we can go very long times. We're, you know, we're the fat-storing ape. Great apes just don't have the ability that we do, and that's probably why we took over the world instead of gorillas.
Yeah, one of the things that impressed me from Jason's new book is that he shared how people who go on very low-calorie diets, who are massively obese, morbidly obese is the term, develop these, I mean, almost everyone's seen them, these massive skin folds, which usually are surgically excised. But when you compare that to someone who's fasting, they don't get that because their body eats those skin folds as they go along. Even, the, you know, they might only be having 200-300 calories a day. It's enough to stop the autophagy process, to abort it. Which is why I just do a complete water fast. I don't take branched chain amino acids. I don't take, only I take care of my supplements, and that's it. And that's not food.
Yeah, you know, years ago, a lot of us studied hibernating bears in learning how to preserve hearts during heart surgery and for heart transplantation. And there was a hibernation factor that bears and other hibernating animals make that's been elusive. But in the process of studying hibernating bears, I became incredibly impressed that, you know, a mother bear goes into the den pregnant. She doesn't eat for 5 months, and she suckles her cubs. I mean, she gives birth to her cubs. She suckles them. And she leaves the den with all of her muscle mass intact. Why? Because if her muscle mass wasn't intact, she couldn't hunt and they'd starve. But the most fascinating thing about it, and I talk about it in the book, is the mother bear doesn't urinate for 5 months. And she doesn't urinate because kidneys have basically two purposes. One, to get rid of the water we either drink or is in our food. And number two, to get rid of protein waste byproducts. And she's not burning her muscle, so she's not burning protein, but she's burning fat. She's eating her fat as ketones. So she's in ketosis for 5 straight months, and she doesn't urinate. So, I mean, and believe it or not, we run the same metabolism as bears. We're an omnivore just like a bear. Bears become insulin resistant every fall to store fat, and we act just like bears. So we have a perfect model to study what happens to humans. And so prolonged fasting in humans has been studied extensively.
So as a healthy adult and convinced of the value of fasting, I'm wondering if you, I know you do intermittent fasting, but I've never discussed your application of multi-day water fasting.